Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. And before I introduce my next guest, I'm going to read a passage from his book. Just like you might pack a favorite sweater for a journey, I take my grill wherever I go. And for this book, I travel to Patagonia, to Paris, from Brazil to Berkeley, locating new ingredients, building fires, making meals that let fire work its timeless magic. All I need, all anyone needs for this primal pleasure is flame and food. If you haven't guessed, Francis Maumann.
Well, hi, how are you?
Thank you so much for being here.
Okay, thank you. Oh, it's very nice being here. Very honored.
So right now in my hand, I have your latest book, On Fire, which is the second book, the follow-up to Seven Fires. Argentinian cooking, or live fire cooking, is obviously what you focus on and was revelatory in New York only a few years ago, be it, you know, DOH, you know, Department of Health, Department of Building Regulations. We weren't allowed to have that much. But with this book, what you've done is transport us in a way saying that you don't really need the biggest space, the biggest fire to be able to actually participate in the kind of cooking you do. Tell me about this journey starting from Argentina.
Well, you know, it has a lot to do with our roots in Argentina, the gaucho, which are cowboys, the way they live. You know, they wake up before dawn with a fire and a steak. They have lunch with a fire and a steak and dinner with fire and steak. So besides that, I'm quite influenced as well by the native cooking of different parts of our country, the Andes with the Incas and their fires. In Patagonia, the Mapuches, and how they cooked, and near the forests in Brazil as well. So, but what I love about fire is, you know, it's sort of a language of life, I think, you know. I think we spend so much time sitting in chairs, and as you said, you know, America has so many regulations and so afraid of fire, you know. And I understand it, you know, in a city, you know, and all the horrible things we do to the air and the sky with smoke. But I think that the idea of going outside and taking in your pocket a tiny fire, and I sometimes take just a couple of eggs and an onion and a little salt in my pocket, and, you know, and you can cook it on a stone, in a hot stone. So there's not much really that you need to cook nicely outside and to have a fire. And I love that idea, you know, sort of get off your chair and go out.
Yeah, and then we're also taping this with no specific time or, you know, place in mind as far as, you know, when you can actually grill. Because I think we're past the summer season, you know, we're moving into fall. And most people reserve that time of the year for grilling, mm-hmm. you know, as Americans call live fire cooking. Why should we be working with fire all year round, in the snow, in the rain?
Well, you know, I think there is this sort of idea that cooking with fire has to do with the summer and a beautiful day. And I think it has a lot to do with winter, you know. I love to be out in the rain. You may make yourself a little shelter for it. I love to cook in the snow. We do it a lot, you know. It's so, so romantic. And I just did last year, I did a TV series of 10 shows of cooking in snowstorms. Not only in the snow, but in the storm. So what I was trying to teach people is how to read the storm, how to get a little shelter, how to start your fire, obviously with no gasoline or anything, just with little sticks, little branches that sort of hang in the trees. And then the other thing is that there's this idea that cooking with fires is sort of a male thing, you know, and it's a rough thing. And I really think and I believe that fire is an extremely tender thing and feminine and very fragile, you know, because it can crack. You can crack the way you're cooking something very fast if you are not really looking into it and you're not very aware of temperatures and wind and so on. So it's a silent language. It's a beautiful language. And, you know, it's simple, but you need quite a bit of knowledge. And the only way to learn it, the only way to learn it is to practice, you know. So, you know, I think that maybe the first step is just to burn a big fire in your backyard on your own and sit in a chair and see what happens as it burns down. You know, and you will see all the stages. You will see the flame, you will see the charcoals, and then the ashes. And those three elements we use a lot for cooking. We use the ashes, we use the coals, and the flames.
Who taught you first about fire? Or do you remember the first fire that you set and watched and sat there and had it convert into, you know, charcoal and ashes?
Well, it was part of our lifestyle when we were kids in Patagonia. You know, we lived in a house that was ruled by fire. We had our chimneys, we had hot water system to have a bath. It was with a fire, and the cooking stove was with fire. We had no propane or, you know, electricity we had, but we didn't use it for all that. So as kids, you know, when the winter came, we knew we had to, you know, sort of log the house up with four truckfuls of wood. And our job was to take it in wheelbarrows to the shed and, you know, classify it by sizes because each fire needed a different size of wood. And we ordered them like that. So we would, you know, spend our days really starting the fires of the house, and we would take turns for it and so on. And then we lived a lot outside. We walked a lot in the mountains as kids. And I used to work as well as, you know, sort of a companion to fly fishermen. So I would stay in the coast doing the fire and cooking the trouts for them when I was 10, 11, 12. And so, you know, it's sort of something that it's inside of me. And I only reached back into it after I became a chef, sort of an accomplished chef, and I wanted to run away from, you know, all my more fancy cooking.
Yeah, and let's talk about that hot French, you know, because when we talk about, you know, building a fire in the home and cooking in that aspect, it seems very rustic, and you're not using the techniques that you might in a Michelin-starred, you know, restaurant in Europe, but at the same time, you do.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, French cooking is very rooted inside of me. Maybe you don't see it today in my recipes, but it is hidden in every recipe I do, you know, because what France taught me, I always say that France was extremely generous and rigorous with me in my upcoming as a chef, and that's inside of me, and I respect them a lot. I admire them a lot. But you know, doing simple food is one of the most difficult things, because when you do food that's very complicated and has many things and many products on it, it's very easy to hide things or to get people confused. But when you have a nice piece of fish that is cooked in the plancha with olive oil and salt, well, you know, it has to be a great fish, it has to be very well cooked, and the olive oil and the salt have to be splendid. And so I love that. I love that simplicity, and I think it's quite difficult to achieve.
So you talk about simplicity, you know, very unassuming ingredients elevated just by cooking techniques. With this book, you traveled all around the world. I mean, to New York. I know you were here at Roberta's for a couple of days working on this book at Brooklyn Bridge Park, but you were also in Paris, in Uruguay, all around the world.
Yeah. So, yeah. what I did with this book is that I went to places that I love, that where my heart lies in a certain way. And, you know, for example, in Paris, I cooked around the city with building fires in the streets for about a month. And I constructed myself a leather, beautiful leather cart that I took from Argentina on wheels that I pushed around the markets and the streets. And I would stop somewhere and cook. And, you know, it took us a very long time to get the permits to do that. What I wanted to do was make a tribute in that case to France and everything that they gave me. And I did a TV show about it. So, and I went and knocked with not letting them know in advance at many of the 3-star restaurants where I worked. And I would just show up there with my cart and I would say, "Hi, my name is Francis. I worked here 30 years ago. Can I come in? Do you want me to light a fire in your door and cook something for you guys?"
And no one thought you were crazy, just this guy pulling this chopper.
Yeah, but you know, the production people said, "No, we have to let them know. Let's call them that you're coming." And I said, "No, I want to be in a hugged by them or kicked out, you know, whatever they do." So it was fun. And then we went to Bolinas. We went to the north of Brazil, where I have a restaurant in Trancoso. Went to Patagonia, to Uruguay, and so it's a bit about cooking with fires and adapting those fires to different products around the world.
You have those products around the world, but let's talk about how portable
your
grills are. Because you talk about roaming the streets of Paris, pulling what behind you, a chapa?
Yeah, well, it was a cart that was about 400 pounds It was quite heavy, but it had wheels, bicycle wheels I constructed especially for that trip. It was leather-bound, and the cart was sort of rectangular, quite high, and it would open up into tables, and it had a fridge with ice inside. It had many, many hanging bags of leather for my shopping and for goods, and I had my casseroles, and I had inside there a portable chapa and grill and little hell that I could build up in a moment. Even a chair to sit down, you know, a sort of a stool that I would break down and keep it there. So, yes, I have, you know, all sort of things for traveling. You know, you can have some tiny chapas that are about, you know, 1 foot by 1/2 foot big that I just take with me in a backpack if I'm in the mountains, or a little grill that size where you can cook for 4 people. And, you know, you just need some stones, some dry wood. And as you said, you know, as I said, maybe you can take even the food in your pockets and cook, you know, chop your onion in your knee and do something delicious and take your parsley and instead of a handkerchief in your jacket.
You know, we talk about these very elemental things, and Seven Fires is based around literally 7 different kinds of fires. You know, the chapa, you have the parrilla. Explain to me all the different fires that you have and how they treat food differently.
Well, a chapa is, you know, it's a cast iron or a very thick iron griddle that can be huge or small. And when it's big, what I like to have is to have a fire in one end of it, and you have very hot place to, you know, to cook a very thin steak of lamb or of beef or of veal. And then in the middle, you can be roasting smashed potatoes till they have a nice thick crust. And then the other end, which is sort of quite hot but not burning, you can be doing pancakes or dessert. So the beauty about a chapa is that with one little fire, you have all these temperatures, and you can have an array of different recipes going, 4 or 5 at the same time, in the different temperatures you have. And that's lovely. That's one. Then we do grill. You know, you guys know a lot about grill. We sort of grill differently because we have a fire on the side and a grill, and we move the charcoals, and we keep on feeding our grill with those charcoals during the cooking time. So I like that very much, and I love to cook very slow in a grill. Then you have rescoldo, which is cooking vegetables or food covered with ashes and cold. So you sort of bury them in a bed of ashes and coals.
Potatoes, beets,
fennel, whole pumpkins, huge or small.
One of my favorite things is you say oranges in this book. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, that's delicious. That's a new thing. So what we do now is we burn a very good orange in sort of charcoal, very red hot charcoal, and it burns in about, I would say, a minute. So most of the cover of the orange, all the skin stays black, but then you break it up and it has this incredible smoky beautiful taste, and it's slightly warm. And I love that with fruits and fire, that you just burn them on one side and they're still raw, but you have the char and the coal and the hot and all that. So that's a new thing, and it's lovely. And we in this new book on fire, I do a recipe which is a bread that is cooking the charcoals, you know, sort of a very thin bread. But you need, so in order for it to burn, funny enough, you need really red, very hot charcoal. If you put it in charcoals that are not very red, it will burn. But if you put it on really hot, red heat charcoal, you can sort of flip it once and it cooks very nicely. And the charcoals may stick for a moment, but then they go away. And then we serve it, you know, with olive oil and the burnt oranges. And, you know, I don't know what else you can add.
That sounds amazing.
It's delicious.
Yeah, I'm incorporating that into my diet immediately. Yeah. I've been a fan of yours for a long time and actually built a wood fire oven a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And with that wood fire oven, you often have a lot of coals that, you know, you can brush out, and I've cooked in ashes before. Another wonderful recipe that you have is taking those coals and just plunging it in pimenton oil.
Yes, yes. Well, the taste of burnt and of smoke and of coals is delicious. So, you know, I do a pimenton oil and I put a couple of really hot quebracho, which is our wood, coals into it, and it really gives a beautiful flavor to the olive oil with the pimenton. Yeah, I love that. It's delicious. Yeah.
So we're just talking about oven, which is one of my favorite ways of cooking. That's the horno.
The horno de barro, yeah. Yes. We like that.
Cooking between two fires?
That's called infiernillo, which in English would be little hell. because you have a fire in the bottom, a fire in the top, and you cook in the middle. And we do a lot of salt crust fish there, or other things, you know, like a whole pig if you do it really slowly. And that comes a bit from the idea that the Incas used to cook in between two stones. You know, they used to do armadillos there. They would crush the armadillo with a stone, put some peanuts on them, like a milanesa, and then just cook it in between two hot stones. And that's lovely. And it's a beautiful technique. It's a very romantic technique. We did it in the streets yesterday in El Buco, and I was sitting in a chair in the middle of a street with hundreds of people around me looking at the fires, and I thought, what a beauty this is. Besides being delicious, you know, every time people see a fire and see that you're cooking with fire, there's sort of there's a language that just bonds you.
And subsequently, it was on Bond Street.
So it was,
it
made
that much more sense. Two other kinds of fires, the asador.
Asador. The asador is cooking on a wooden cross or in an iron cross, and you do whole animals there. You can do lamb, you can do goat, you can do, you know, deer, you can do cow. And so basically it's a standing structure that slightly leans on the fire, and then you cook very, very slowly. So I cook a lamb in 7 hours, very slowly, and you cook it mostly on one side, I would say 80% of the time on the side of the bones. You butterfly it, and then when you touch the other side and it's slightly warm, it's cooked, and then you just turn it for a fast crunch, or, you know.
We're going to talk about time a little bit more, because that's a very important thing when it comes to fire, and I kind of want to get your feelings on chimneys, you know, the things to start grills, whether or not that's the way to do it, or if you have to be a little more methodical and slower and really, you know, feed that fire with your love. You know, there's also one more fire, and then we're going to take a quick break. Yeah. But the coldor?
The caldero.
Yes.
Caldero. Caldero is a basically a Dutch oven, and it's wonderful for frying or for cooking stews outside or for doing polenta on a fire and doing soups, you know. I love to do soups outside. And so maybe what we do is we first sort of burn some and cook some vegetables in the ashes for the taste of it, and then with that we start a soup in El Caldero, you know, and you get very beautiful ones in America. I found, you know, you have from the last century antique ones, very big ones, and they're done freshly and new too, but if you look online you will find beautiful calderos.
Excellent. With that, we're going to take a quick break and come back and actually talk about wood.
Okay.
You can't have fire without wood.
Yeah, that's right.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. We'll be right back. And welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with live fire cooking master Francis Malman. I rarely get to quote Billy Joel during my shows, but it's not really a direct quote, but, you know, when did you start the fire? It's kind of an iteration on one of the songs for your Bond Street event the other day.
And we started at midnight. We sort of hanged two big pigs of 300 pounds each. We constructed with a welder that day sort of an A-frame for them, and we hanged them for about 12 hours. So they roasted very, very slowly.
Yeah, so how important is time? Before we start going in the wood, you want to foster that flame, that flavor.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a very quick cooking.
No, you need patience for cooking with fires, and I think that's the beauty of it, you know, pulling up a chair and looking your things cook and learn how, where, and when to add wood, depending on the wind, depending on how your beast looks when it's cooking and it's sort of, you know, getting crispy. So there's a whole language there that you have to learn, and we can talk about it and I can tell you many details, but the true way of learning is to do it, you know, because it's very nice, you know. I love to sit around my fires and I can tell just by looking at them what's happening with them, you know. The wind changed, so we changed the position of the food. We changed the way the place where the fire is, we move it here, we move it there, because, you know, you're outside and things change a lot outside in 12 hours, you know. You can start with a beautiful sunny day and suddenly you're in the rain and suddenly you're in the sun again, you know. That happens to us very often. So you have to learn that, and timing is very important, very important.
Yeah, we keep on talking about this other element, wind, which when I built my wood fryer oven, it's behind a cottage across from a lake. I didn't even think of wind at that point, but how important it is and how much you actually have to watch out for it is fascinating, because, you know, if it's whipping off that lake, I have to have that door like slightly ajar for anything not to, you know, smoke up like crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a whole other factor.
Yeah, wind is very important. At first, it's extremely dangerous because a change of wind can put a tree on fire, a bush on fire, you know, so you have to be very aware of that and be very careful with the environment. But wind as well. The bad thing about grilling things for a long time with wind is that the food gets sort of relaxes, the muscle relaxes with the heat and starts cooking, and then a cold wind comes and it goes, you know, and it goes like that all the time. So, and you will probably have quite a tough meat if it's a very windy day. It's not very good for the meat.
Yeah.
Because of the change, the constant changes of temperature, hot, cold, hot, cold. They don't like that.
That's why you built shelter in your snowstorm.
Yeah. You don't want wind.
Yeah.
You want to protect yourself from the wind when you're grilling, and especially if you're grilling for a long time, you know. The beauty about grilling for a long time is that the muscle just sort of relaxes and gives up to love, just like a lady does, or we do.
Yeah.
But, you know, imagine a lady, if you throw a bucket of hot cold water to her every 10 seconds, she won't be too happy. The meat either.
Yeah. Jack, you're going to appreciate this segue from ladies to wood. Let's talk about your wood. There was a very specific kind that you use in Argentina and love. What is that called?
It's called quebracho. It's a sort of a redwood from El Chaco, from north of our country. And it's a beautiful wood. It's hard as a rock. It doesn't almost make any flame. So it just burns and makes these huge red coals that last forever. And for us, it's very important, the ashes from the fires the days before. We always keep that, because what we do is, when we have all these beautiful coals, we make a bed of coals and we cover it with white ashes, and that protects the heat and the coals for many hours. If you leave them in the air, they will just burn out. But if you cover them with ashes, they stop burning, they remain red for many hours, and then you start opening those little holes in your ashes to get the heat out as you need it. And it's a wonderful way to use less wood and to keep your heat.
And it's also a living thing in that way, because you have to take from your past fire to be able to control your next fire.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my chimneys at home, I sort of get my ashes once in a while through a sieve to take all the pieces of charcoal and really keep just remain with the white ashes, and because they're beautiful for cooking, even in the chimney, you know.
Say we're in New York, which we are right now, and you don't have your famed wood of Argentina. What woods would you use here?
Well, you know, you can use a Weber to cook. I have adapted some Webers where, you know, you can use a plancha on them. Ideally is to have two of them. One you use for burning wood and getting coals, and then you shovel from there to the other one to keep replenishing your grilling, you know. And you can even hang things. I love hanging food, you know, chickens, ribeyes, lamb, you know, the back leg of a lamb, the gigot. And I cook like that, you know, maybe for 8-9 hours. It's very beautiful.
The pictures in this book are very beautiful as well, because there's a couple of lamb legs just hanging over an open flame, kind of like piñatas or you know, weeping willows. It's just a stunning thing to see. So I've written down a note that I have to buy a second grill, because I have a chimney right now, and you've used chimneys before, I'm assuming.
I use it all the time.
Yeah. So they're a good thing.
They're a good thing because, you know, you're heating your home. You're enjoying it, you're reading, and suddenly it's 5 and you say, well, I want to have a steak at 8 or at 5 or at 7. And you put your grill on, you burn it a bit, and you know, and you're going to do your steak there, and on the side you're going to do in the ashes some vegetables. So, you know, it can't get better than that.
Well, it does get better than that. Let's talk about some recipes. And we all know chimichurri.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to this book. I saw you grilling aged ricotta. I saw you griddling pears with prosciutto. What are some of your favorite recipes from this book, and have they been in your repertoire for years?
Yeah, well, the new ones, there's a very nice salmuera of oranges that I like. That's very good for chicken and for meat, which is it has nothing to do with the chimichurri, but sort of an olive oil sauce that I really like. Then I love, obviously, that we talked about the oranges and the bread and the colds. Then there are some. There's a very classic recipe of a sort of a ribeye steak with maître d'hôtel butter that I like very, very much. There's some very nice desserts. There's a pionono. They're all burnt afterwards, you know, sort of.
Yeah.
You make a cake, you fill it up, and then you burn it on the grill or in a plancha.
Is that the one with the strawberries and the dulce de leche?
Yeah, that's a pionono, which is a... It's a very classic thing in Argentina, and I just took it into the grill after to give it a little bit of, you know, taste.
And then, you know, there's chimichurri, but there's, on the other spectrum, dulce de leche. Tell me about that, because it strikes a chord throughout the whole book.
Yeah, well, it's a love affair for us, dulce de leche, you know. It's very sweet. Many people don't understand it, or they find it a bit overwhelming in taste and in sugar. But we love it. We are raised on it, and it has a lot to do with the romance of our country. And so it's very present in our desserts, you know, and we have a creme caramel of dulce de leche. We have pancakes of dulce de leche. We have cakes. I don't know. We have so many things. Dulce de leche is very important in our culture.
So you're not all just about fire. You're a sweet guy, too.
I am. I hope so. I hope so.
Absolutely. A couple more recipes. I see a lot of interplay with potatoes.
Yeah.
You know, you have almost like a galette where you do really thinly sliced potatoes and then chicken on top of that inverted onto a plate. I mean, that's a thing of beauty.
That's very, and so delicious too, yeah. So what you do is, what I do is you get a double breast of a chicken, and so you butterfly it, so it's still attached, both of them, and you put a galette on top. On one of the sides, and the potato naturally it will stick to the chicken, and then you flip it and you cook it on that side until the potatoes are really crisp and crunchy, and then you flip it over and you finish it cooking, and you have this beautiful mix of crunch and potatoes stick to your breast of chicken, and it's very delicious.
Yeah,
I like it. Yeah,
I thought that was a fascinating way of cooking on a single side, which you do a couple more times. And one of the other really interesting one is the tuna churrasco. How do you say?
Tuna churrasco.
Churrasco, yeah.
Yeah, churrasco. Churrasco is a beautiful term in our culture. It's, you know, it started in the farms where they had these wood oven and cast iron cooking stoves. So, you know, it was maybe lunchtime and everybody was having lunch. And suddenly, as happens a lot in the farms, a couple of unexpected guests show up and there's no more food. And a churrasco is sort of doing on the stove, on the cast iron, with no pans or anything, straight on it, a not very thick steak, which usually it's done with rump, with cuadril. And so what I do in the book is do the same thing with a churrasco of tuna, sort of burning it on both sides on a cast iron grill very fast.
Yeah.
Delicious.
And one of my favorites, which I'm certainly trying soon, is the crusty rice.
Yeah. Well, that's a recipe from Iran. When I was a young boy learning how to cook in Paris, I had this friend from Iran, and he one day, on Saturday, told me that he wanted me to learn how to choose rice. So he took me to a store where they had all the rices in bags, and he learned me how to smell the rice and how to choose it and so on. And then he cooked for me this rice that you make very, very crunchy, very, you know, you really sort of char it slightly, and you cook it with a piece of cloth on top of it. It's very nice. It's very delicious. It's a very good garnish for love.
Yeah. Well, let's end with love, too, because obviously you love fire. You love wood. You love this subject so much. What can you say about it to make other people love it?
Well, you know, it's about taking time, I think. It's about, fire has to do with saying, okay, well, maybe today or this afternoon I'll stop. And I take my children, my lover, my wife, my brother somewhere, and I'll cook with fire, you know. And so it's about that. It's about stopping this life where we live in which is so crowded with so many things, with phones, with internet, with WhatsApp and Instagrams and whatever it is, and saying, well, hold on, I'm going to stop and I'm going to enjoy some fresh air and talk. Because I ultimately, the only reason to eat nice things and to have a glass of wine is to have better conversations. For me, there's no other reason. It has nothing to do with art. It's just, you know, the pleasure of talking, because food and wine enhances our thoughts. It makes us more witty, more acute, and we say better things when we eat and drink. And I think that that's the most beautiful thing about eating and drinking.
Well, I agree. And next time we'll do this around a fire.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Francis, for being on The Eternal Flame. Francis Malman, On Fire, in stores right now. Get this book. It's wonderful. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harling Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.